Good morning, everybody. My name is Vishwas Lele. As you can see on the slide, I work for a company called Applied Information Sciences, and which is based in the Washington, D.C. area. And I've been working on Azure-related technologies for many years now, 6, 7 years, and I'm also an Azure MVP. I'm here to talk about this session, which you're probably noticing this title and saying, this looks slightly different from the title we see on the agenda. And you know, for some reason, they did not want to put cloud in there. And you know, of course, this session is really about availability threat in the cloud. And really, the motivation for this talk was, you know, after having taken many customers to the cloud and working with production systems, and then sitting in on major incident calls, which often get triggered after a partial outage happens. And in the cloud, those major incident calls when a cloud outage happens are really frustrating because, you know, you don't have as much control over things. So having sat through many of those calls, you know, it slowly grew on me that, you know, we need to think about failure slightly differently. Maybe we should be focusing on recovery, because everybody wants to have the system back up and running, so we should be focusing more on recovery. So I borrowed this term called the threat model, which many of you are familiar with, the Security Development Lifecycle, Microsoft's Trustworthy Computing Initiative. I borrowed that term from there, and I said, would it make sense to apply it to availability? And maybe we should treat availability on par with the way we treat security upfront. And that thought, maybe 18 months back or 2 years back, led me to a journey, to research, and I'm here to share that research with you. So that's essentially, in a nutshell, what the talk is going to be. Let me just motivate the talk a little bit further. So, you know, the cloud debate is over, as somebody just recently said. IT departments, whether it's government enterprises or commercial enterprises, they are moving a material portion of their applications to the cloud. No question, it's happening. And however, you know, we may have done a too good of a job of selling the cloud, because people look at utility billing, people look at 3 nines, 4 nines, financially backed SLAs, and people start to assume that they're getting utility grade availability. And as I will talk through subsequent slides, that is not realistic, at least not realistic when you just get and deploy your application, just lift and shift your application. That expectation is not realistic. So what you need to do here, based on my experience, is our traditional checks, you know, code reviews, design reviews are not enough. We need to focus on availability more. And then, as I said earlier, focus on recovery, because there is going to be this unpredictability because you're dealing with so many services that you better embrace failure and focus for recovery, and we'll talk about many recovery scenarios. And then the last bullet item here is, so you have to think of availability as a first class object as part, and upfront, think about availability when you're bringing these applications to the cloud, when you're doing a lift and shift, or you're building a cloud native application, do that. So think of this slide as really motivation for my session. Think of this also as call to action, and I'll have a similar slide at the end, and I want to make sure I've covered most of the bullets here. So the agenda here is pretty simple. The first two bullets are conceptual, and the last two bullets are sort of applying some of the concepts and showing you some demos. Okay? So that's the agenda we have here. So let me talk about availability and public cloud. Why are they together, and why are we talking about that together? So when I started talking about, you know, higher probability of failure in the cloud, you know, many of my customers, many of the folks in my company even said, oh, so are you saying that cloud is inherently susceptible, more susceptible to failures? If that is the case, I'm not going to go to the cloud, or maybe I should just wait and then you know, stand the sides for a couple of years, let the industry decide. What I'm here to tell you that cloud by itself, if you look at it, if you've looked at the progression of the cloud, the services themselves are not inherently unreliable. Just look at the work that has happened. You started out with very commodity VMs. Now, Azure itself, we have a 32-core G-series machines. We started out with 5,000 IOPS on storage. Now we have 50,000 IOPS. We started out with an Azure SQL database, a web and business tier, where we used to get a lot of transient faults because of the shared infrastructure. Now we have dedicated DTUs. ExpressRoute, for example, has a redundant dual channel built into it. So it's not like these services are not reliable. It's you just can't expect to just cobble together these services and then have these reliability aspects translate to your application. So you're saying, okay, so the cloud is not reliable, then you're talking about recovery. Why am I still going to the cloud? Well, it's a trade-off that you're making. Most people who are going to the cloud today are going for one and one reason alone, which is time to value. They want to build software quickly. So we are making a trade-off. We are building these composite applications, which are dependent on these multiple higher order services, so we'd have to write less code. And the trade-off is that we are giving up some control. And that's a trade-off that we want to make because our competitors are certainly making that trade-off. So how we make this trade-off work for us, given that it is a complex system, the probability of failure, how does we make this trade-off work? Well, we make it work by thinking about recovery ahead and by having this sort of a recovery bubble around our application, we can sort of have the best of the time to value and also the availability and resilience for our applications. So that's really the important concept I'm trying to drive home. This slide essentially talks about more details to the previous slide. Mark Sims, who's in the Patterns and Practices group, very interesting guy. If you get a chance, listen to his talks. He talks about how we have, in an on-premises environment, there are failures everywhere, but in an on-premises environment, we have purpose-built, isolated environments, and then we have thrown so much hardware at it. And he has an interesting term. We've all come to rely on this titanium eggshell for reliability of our applications, and that eggshell is missing when we move to the cloud. So if you are thinking about failures, if you're saying that failures are going to happen, how do you deal with this? And as I started doing more research, clearly there are other engineering disciplines who've been dealing with failures, if not for decades, certainly, if not more. So that led me to some research. Let me share you very quickly. One of the first ones is failure mode effect analysis. You can look this up. This was came into being in 1950s for military-grade applications. And the idea is simple. You look at the system. You think what failures can happen, what causes of the failure. You can think of the various effects it causes, the severity, and things like that. And it's really based on inductive reasoning. Look at the problem and see what failures can happen. This model, FMEA, is today also being used in, for example, healthcare industry today. If you search for FMEA healthcare, you'll find some software packages that give you how to deal with these failures. Very interesting. So as I did more research, then I ran into a very interesting book called Normal Accidents, Dealing with High-Risk Technologies. And I read that book, and I want to share a couple of examples from that book. The first example is, many of you know this, is the Three Mile Island partial nuclear reactor meltdown in 1979, I believe. And I'm not a mechanical engineer, so I do my best to describe this, but there are a couple of lessons for us to take as we build cloud applications. So 28 March 1979, the secondary water pump goes bad because there's a water leakage, the moisture goes into the instrumentation, it confuses the system, the secondary water pump shuts down. That's not a problem. These systems are built for reliability. The emergency water pump comes on, and there's an indicator that says emergency pump came on. However, the mechanical valves for that pump are both co-located, and this is an example of a latent error. By that I mean an error waiting to happen. So these valves are sitting together, both of these valves are turned manually off. So the emergency came on, but these valves are closed. So at this point, what's happening is the pressure is building, the temperature is building. You run into a situation where the nuclear chain reaction is stopped because of high temperature, and now pressure is building. Nuclear reactors are built with safety in mind, obviously, so there are things like automatic safety device. So one of the first safety devices that comes along is a pressure valve which opens so that the pressure comes out because the pressure is building. Imagine a kettle with latent heat in it, and you block the kettle. At some point, you know, something is going to happen. So this pressure valve comes on, and so it starts releasing pressure, and after a few minutes, the pressure valve is designed to shut off. It does not shut off. And this is a common problem, so they have an indicator for that too. Turns out that the indicator fails on 28th March, that indicator fails. So now you have people on the sitting in front of the control panel, looking at the control indicators, one showing that the pressure is decreasing because the valve came on, but the temperature is increasing. You know why? Because the coolant is escaping through the hole. So they are not used to seeing these two indicators go on simultaneously. And they are confused by it. Of course, there's another automatic safety device, which is called the high pressure injection. That comes on, starts pouring water, and these guys are still confused by the two sort of indicators, and they turn the high pressure injection off within 2 minutes. And when there's a research on why this problem happened, they said, oh, this is operator error. They should not have stopped this HPI. But think about it. Let's take this example here that I described in the last minute and apply it to cloud applications. You probably have managed services team, and you gave them some queries to run. Maybe they're running some Splunk queries or App Insight queries, and you told them to run certain queries, and if something happens, please call the development team or someone else. But it's really not their fault if these indicators are confusing. That's number one. The other important lesson to learn from this is when we are designing the system, I'm sure you've been in these discussions when you talk to an architect and say, well, you know, what about this piece, this node in this application? It is not protected. What if it goes down? And you know, answer often is, you know, the probability of this happening is so low because, you know, we pull these messages every 30 seconds, so highly unlikely. What is happening here is they never expected the system to fail in these ways where these unrelated parts connected together to cause the failure. I guarantee you, look at any root cause analysis of a major cloud failure in the last 5-7 years. They've all come together because little improbable things came together and made that happen. Okay, so two important lessons there. So for us, how do we reduce latent errors in the cloud? And one of the common examples is that, you know, when you are absolutely in the heat of the situation, people tend to, okay, I'm going to open Notepad and make a configuration change because everything else is not working. Error waiting to happen. And how do you educate the operator so that they can deal with these indicators that don't make sense? One more quick example, and then I'll move on from this topic, is no discipline is dealing with failure more than civil engineering discipline. And you know, back in the 18th century, when they were building railroad bridges, you know what, from 1850 to 1890, a quarter of these bridges used to fail. Can you imagine that? A quarter of these bridges used to fail. And they found out that the way to solve this, the big aha moment to solve this problem was they would do all the designs for the bridges, and then they will multiply it with a factor of 3 to 6, and they used to call it factor of ignorance. And that was the key sort of thing that allowed them to build more resilient bridges. And that practice continued on until early 2000, and now we have more sophisticated things. So what is that margin of ignorance in the cloud, right? So when we run multiple secondaries and we are making this decision about, and you'll see me demo this, I have an Azure SQL database in one instance and I can have up to 4 secondaries. What is that margin of ignorance that I need to have? Moving on. So if failures are going to happen, failures are a reality, we have a problem. But is it a problem? Look at this quote, for example, from Shimon Peres, very interesting quote. If a problem has no solution, maybe it is not a problem. It is in fact, indeed a fact, and it cannot be solved. You just need to deal with it. So how do you deal with it? You deal with it by building resilience into your design. So moving on, changing gears. Up until now, we have talked about engineering disciplines. Let's just move on. How does it all apply to computing? And turns out that Berkeley did some very interesting work in 2002. And they have a very interesting paper. I'll have a link to it on the next slide. And if you get a chance, read it. They talked about recovery-oriented computing back in 2002. This paper came out in 2002. They talked about embracing failures. At that time, they were very concerned that the industry was focused on just performance and not resilience. So they talked about, guys, you need to embrace failures, you need to have coping strategies. And they were the first ones to talk about this. So when you move to the cloud, often, let's say you're doing managed services, people will say, what is the time between failures? And people trying to maximize that. IT has always tried to do that. And this is the first time we've talked about time to recover or time to mediate. Okay, that's an important thing. So some other principles of ROC, very interesting here. They talk about recovery experiments in 2002. We call this something very interesting today. Netflix popularized this concept of chaos monkey, right? Running chaos tests. That's the remediation, repair mechanisms, experiments that you're talking about. Aids to diagnosis, telemetry built into your application, how you can partition your application so that you don't have a major failure, how you can have reversible systems, ability to roll back to last known good. So they talked about things that just apply today. So moving on, what Microsoft did here, and this is the time topic I want to focus on for a few more minutes here. So Microsoft Trustworthy Computing Group, as I was doing more research, I found this interesting white paper that they'd written. They took the principles that we had just talked about up until now. They took recovery-oriented computing, they took failure mode effect analysis, and they created this methodology called the resilience modeling and analysis. And turns out that this is being used today by internal teams to improve resilience. So according to RMA, you address reliability issues early in the design. You prioritize, this key, prioritize reliability. This is the key to success in the cloud related to other work efforts. And then, you know, you have a continuous feedback loop where you learn from your failures and then put them back into your reliability design. And I have a link at the bottom if you want to go take a look. So RMA process looks like this. You document, discover. Let's just talk through these phases. So the first phase is the document phase, as you would expect. And the RMA team, who were designed RMA, came out with a new type of a diagram. I'm sure you're familiar with all the UML diagrams. They came out with a diagram called the component interaction diagram. And this diagram is key. You'll see an example of this momentarily. This example is key to thinking about failures because it shows all kinds of interactions, okay? Once you have created an interaction diagram, then you have a workbook which translates some of these ideas into this, and then this allows you to discover faults. That's generally the idea. So what is included in the component interaction diagram? It includes all of the resources. It includes cardinality, how many instances are running. It includes region. It includes even throttling, fault domains, and things like that. And I'll show you an example in a moment. So here's an example let's see if I can just. Yep, so I was just trying to see if I could zoom more into it, and let's just see if I can. Yep, that's better. So you can see here, let me just call out a few things. Here's a sample diagram. So we have table storage, see the yield sign? This tells you that this resource actually can throttle you. And if you've worked with the storage, you know that the storage API can actually throttle you. This yield sign shows you that. It shows you the SLAs right here. It shows you, and certificates are often a cause of failure. And these are color-coded certificates, which is the client part, which is the server part. It talks about the fault domains here and how many update domains. And equally importantly, it talks about you're calling an external service, what is the SLA associated with that, and it talks about the number of role instances that are running. And then one other important thing to note is it also talks about, you know, every interaction is given a number, and this number is then translated into a workbook, okay? So let me go to the next slide here. And this is an example of the RMA workbook. So every interaction that I showed you, we have an interface description, okay? So we take these two artifacts, and then we go into the discovery phase. And then this is a phase where typically you'll get people from networking, people from development team, security, what have you, and they sit around and say, okay, what are the different failure categories? Let's describe the failures. What are the consequences? How do we detect it? Do we have a detection strategy for that failure? And then how long will it take for us to detect that? All these are important. Then how do you do recovery? And these are some of the, this is not an exhaustive list, but these are the common failure categories. So you may fail to discover a service, you may get an incorrect response, you may not get authorized, and so on and so forth, right? This is not an exhaustive list. You can add to it as you see fit. So then you have the rate process, where now you have sat down with the team, and you have discovered all the interactions, you have discovered the faults, you have categorized them, you have assigned how to detect it and things like that, and then you go about rating it. This is where you need to get business involved, because they are the ones who can tell you what will be the impact, is it a minor annoyance, is this a big deal. And the rate process also talks about, once it is detected, how much time will it take to mitigate this, and so on and so forth, right? So that's the rate. And then finally, what we do is we get the management, get the business stakeholders, get the partners together, assign a risk, and as you would expect, then you have the last step of the process, which is to act on this. And then how do you act on it? This is done up front, so you are creating prioritized list of failures and then creating work items for your engineering team. Keep in mind that this process should not just be done once. You need to do this periodically because things change. And then as you learn from failures, you add more chaos tests and things like that. So pretty self-explanatory. But this RMA workbook and a document actually gives you a way to apply this. Okay? So hopefully this helps. All right, so that concludes sort of the conceptual portion of the talk. I just want to make sure. Doing good on time. So let's just now, up until now we have focused more on sort of the cloud or generic aspects. And in the second section, I'm going to talk more about Azure related services. Okay. So how do you apply RMA? And really there are three approaches to applying RMA. And first one is you start with an end-to-end scenario. So you look at the failures from an end user's perspective. What are the different failures an end user can encounter, right? You don't look at the system view, but just the end user view. The second one is most failures happen at the cloud services boundary, and you want to do a deep dive on that and analyze this. And the third one is, which we'll get into the code aspects of it, there are some key components in your system, and you want to take a deeper dive into those components, right? So there are three approaches. You want to use a combination of them or all of them as you see fit. So let's talk about the end-to-end scenario first. And hopefully, let me just zoom into this as well here. So this is an end-to-end scenario. And in this case, this is a mobile device. And I'm only modeling one scenario. This is a mobile device. And this mobile device is interacting with these services. So the experience will be go to Azure AD, get an authentication token, then go to this web role and get some kind, do some work here, and then ultimately upload some information in some storage. Let's just say these are the use cases here, right? So look at the end-to-end scenario. What will happen if Azure AD is unavailable or if they cannot log on? What will happen if the web role is busy and they can't connect to it? What happens if they go to upload some artifact into storage, maybe a picture? What is the reaction? Is it a minor thing? Can they continue to use the app without that? So model those things there, okay? And if I look at the RMA for this, this is an example right here. And in fact, let me do this. I have actually more built out workbook here, and let me just bring it here. You can see this. So, and this is available as part of the Microsoft download as well. And you can see here, so basically all of the ones that relate to the device right here are related to this scenario. And you can see here, I have an interaction description. What are the different kinds of failures that can happen? Description, consequences, how are we going to detect it? what is our recovery strategy, what are the different effects, what portions are impacted, and things like that. So this is a great example of the RMA workbook. Okay. So this is the end-to-end scenario. Let's now talk about cloud service boundary approach. And in order to sort of explain this, what I've done is I have created a base architecture of an Azure application. And what we will do is we will bring up the base architecture, and then we will try to do a cloud services based, apply RMA at the cloud services level. Okay, so let's do that. So here is this base architecture right here. And let me just walk you through a sort of moderately complex architecture. And what I'm going to do is let's just talk through these next five slides and talk about the different kinds of failures. And I actually went ahead and created this configuration in Azure, and we'll go take a look at that next. So let's just, right here, you can see I have a web app. Okay. Most of you are familiar with app service environment. This is a premium offering from Microsoft, where they give you a dedicated instance of a web app that runs on your virtual network. Okay, so it's a dedicated instance. Many of you have used it, right? So I have a dedicated instance right here. So this dotted line here is the virtual network. So this web app gets deployed on the virtual network. So it's private peered with your rest of the services. Then I have a virtual machine here, which is running some third-party software. Then I have an Azure Cache, and Azure Cache premium offering also gives you a way to deploy that Azure Cache right into your VNet. Everybody with me so far, right? You've seen these queues. We deploy that to another subnet, and then of course we have these public peered services. My web app talks to storage table, it talks to Azure SQL database, and it talks to a service bus, okay? So if this is the architecture, sorry, if this is the architecture, you know, you're feeling pretty good about the reliability of this architecture, right? I have an isolated instance of web app. Every web app is running three copies. It is giving me a high SLA. Similarly, Azure SQL database, I'm running a premium SKU. I'm getting 4 nines. And then I have Redis cache. I have 3 nines. So I'm feeling pretty good about the local resilience of this architecture. But think about some things that can go wrong, right? What if my VNet becomes unavailable, for example. And I'm not talking about a data center level outage, just a partial outage that impacts my VNet. So suddenly, despite having all of this resilience, now my application is not functioning, right? So one of the approaches to solve this problem is to, let's say, bring in a service called the Traffic Manager, which many of you already know. And I'll just very quickly describe that. So what we are going to do is we are going to, and this is where the cloud resilience comes in, the configuration that I showed you in the previous slide, that entire configuration is just one ARM template that I built. And you can just run that ARM template in a second data center and have that come up in another region, and then use something like a traffic manager to connect the two. So what does the traffic manager give us? It can route traffic across regions. And the idea is that, you know, some kind of a health check is being performed every 30 seconds, and there's a 10-second timeout. If 4 unsuccessful attempts happen, then your endpoint instance is marked degraded, and all the traffic starts flowing to the second instance, right? Traffic Manager is not a regional service. It's a global service, as you would imagine. So once we bring the Traffic Manager into the mix, how does our architecture look like? And this is what our architecture looks like. Let me zoom into this moment here. So right here, exactly the same architecture, the same traffic. You know, I have region 1 here, and then I have region 2. All I did was I took the ARM template, deployed it to second region, and now I have a traffic manager connecting the two. Okay. And now, if I look at it, if my web app becomes unavailable for some reason, at least my customers, within a few seconds after the 4 tryouts happen, or timeouts happen, they'll be redirected to the second region. Okay, so I've built more resilience. However, I've not completely solved the problem. What if I fail over to the second region, but my databases are not being replicated, right? I've not turned on the replication. So let's look at that next. So Azure SQL Database has a great capability called the active geo-replication. And the idea here is that you are asynchronously replicating committed transactions across a local data center or a different region altogether. And then once you have up to 4 secondaries, you can initiate a failover, and we'll see this in action hopefully in a moment. You can initiate a failover to a second region. Now keep in mind that, you know, if you're looking at the recovery point objectives, this replication might take some time, a few seconds or whatever, 30 seconds. So you can potentially lose some data. So if you wanted to not lose the data, and you can, after committing a transaction in the primary region, you can run this SP-weight database copy sync, which is a synchronous call which will make sure that whatever you've committed in one region gets committed to the second region. Of course, has latency impact. Okay, just wanted to call that out. So in our configuration right now, we have 2 regions. In the first region, we have a web app connected. In the second region, we have a web app connected to the Azure SQL database. When we fail over to the second region, one of 2 things can happen. In my second region, I can continue to go talk to my primary database instance in the other region and take the additional latency hit. Or I can set up active geo-replication. And then when something happens, I know my web app is down, I can come in and do a failover to a secondary. So my secondary becomes primary. And the nice thing about this is that you also have the fail back capability built in, which is an important thing. Many, you know, you have to think about this. You fail over to the secondary, and now your primary data center comes up. You want it to come up, and then you want it to get all of the transactions and then come up to speed, and then you should be able to fail back to the primary, you know, and that's possible with the active geo replication. So this is what the architecture looks like once again. And now if you see, in addition to the traffic manager here, what we have also done is we have set up a geo-replication between this as the primary, and I have set up another region, and this becomes my secondary. And I can have 3 more of these. And you will see this demo in a moment. I have my region 1 as US West, and region 2 as Southeast Asia. Okay. All right, so we've improved the availability of our application. Now, if the web app goes down, we'll go to the second region, and now we will notice that our Azure SQL database is down. We will do a manual failover. And now our database will also be in the secondary data center, and we can still continue to function. However, there are a few other things that can go wrong. So let's just talk about this in this slide before I actually progress on to the next slide. So the other thing that can potentially go wrong is, remember, we have the storage right here. What about storage? Is that being replicated? And turns out that, you know, when I'm setting up a storage account, I can say I want to enable an RAGRS, which means read accessible geo-replicated storage. So whatever is stored in my primary data center is being replicated into a secondary data center. And there is a delay, and there's an API. I think I have a slide on that. Let's just go there. Yes, so it's about a 15-minute delay. There is an API which you can call to see where you are in that delay. There is no SLA on this replication, by the way. And if that is a concern for you, then you know there's a GitHub library called RTable, which is a synchronous geo-replicated table library that somebody put out. Think about that, because you know it does have latency impact, but that is available just in case you need it. What is really interesting is that if you have a secret key to access the primary table in primary region, the same key continues to apply in the secondary region. Okay. And that's an important thing to note. So what does our diagram look like now? Well, our diagram looks something like this. So now we have taken care of the web app problem. We've taken care of the database problem. And then we have also set up this RAGRS right here. Okay. So now, we have still not quite solved all our problems, right? So the web app goes down, Azure SQL database goes down, the storage becomes unavailable. But we also, you probably remember, we had a VM in there which was running a third-party application, right? Everybody remember that? That VM, you know that a single VM, you don't get an SLA, right? You have to have 2 VMs in an availability set, which means that these 2 VMs are located in two separate fault domains or different racks. They don't share a top-of-the-rack switch and so on and so forth. However, and this is the problem that we ran into, despite your two VMs being in an availability set, we inadvertently put the images that are powering these VMs into the same storage account, okay? So even though your VMs are running on two different racks, they are powered by a disk which is in the same storage account, okay? So how do we get around that problem? And one of the things listed here on this slide is that if you are using stateless applications, then there is something called the VM scale set, where you just give one image. And you know, I'll show this to you in a moment. When you create a VM scale set, all you have to run an ARM template. They actually distribute your storage accounts to give you higher resilience. So you have to think about that. I wanted to call out my favorite new feature called the new in-place migration. I'm sure many of you have received an email saying your machine will be rebooted because the host OS is being patched. They have something called the in-place migration where they don't have to reboot the host OS to apply patches. So they're doing a lot of work to improve the availability of VMs, and things like VM scale sets go a long way. Also recommend that you use premium storage if you can, and then spread out your storage accounts across for different VMs, okay? Okay, so fine. So this is the update 4, and this is what it looks like. I just zoom into this, and this is the part I want to talk about. So previously, I had two VMs here, and now what I've replaced them with is a VM scale set, which gives me an ability to spin machines up and down. I don't need to pre-provision these machines. And then I've also put an intermediate load balancer in front, okay? And what I typically want to do is I want to put that in a subnet, put that ILB in that subnet, and that is where my VM scale set is deployed. Why would I want to do that? Typically, you want to do network segmentation. You want to apply network security groups to protect that subnet. So we are not quite done yet. I think we have handled a lot of these, but we are not quite done yet. We have handled web app, database, storage. The one thing that is still left out is the service bus. So what happens if we fail over to the second region? What happens to my service bus? So the way service bus reliance works is like this. You can have a service bus created in another region, and then right now what you need to do today is in your code you want to send copy of your message to both the regions, and it can be an active-active region, or it can be an active-passive. If the active region fails, then you start sending, in which case you might lose data. The important thing to take away from this slide is that if you're trying to build in service bus resilience, you need to incorporate duplicate message handling in your application, because there are chances that same message may appear twice or be get processed twice, so you need to have duplicate message handling built into your application. Okay, so with that said, what we are going to do here is I'm going to go into, I promised you here that, let me bring this up here. And let's just go here. So I have a resource group which is based in West US, okay? The resource, you, I'm sure, familiar with the concept of resource group, a logical container for your resources. And what is interesting about this is that resource group can contain resources across many regions. So it's not located, dedicated to one region alone. So I've created a resource group. And then resource group by itself has a location. I've stored it in the West US. Let's take a quick look at all the resources that are contained inside it. And a lot of resources. And let me just call out a few of them. Oh, this screen won't allow me to zoom in. I'm going to do something that I shouldn't be doing, but okay. much better. Okay, so you can see here that in that resource group, I have a Redis cache in West region. I have a Redis cache in Southeast Asia. I have a VM scale set. I have an internal load balancer, for example. And then notice here, this is the traffic manager. And this is global, as you would imagine, because it's not tied to any region. Then I have a virtual network for US West. I have a virtual network for Southeast Asia. Let me just go further down and just call out some of the more important things here. And then I have my SQL Server instance in Southeast Asia. And then similarly in West US, here's the database. There are the two databases here. The West US is the primary. The Southeast Asia is the secondary. These are all of the storage accounts that were created by the VM scale set. Good thing that they spread it out. So that gives me high availability. And then if I go further down here, this is my app service environment. And inside the app service environment, I have an app service plan. And then finally, I have the web app. Okay, so I've essentially recreated that entire configuration that you saw in that slide. And it was just a simple matter of running. This is the entire ARM template for this. Okay, I just ran this entire ARM template and then ran it in West US, ran it in the other data center. So let's just go back here. Let me just call out a few interesting things, and then I'll do a quick failover as well. Let's go into the traffic manager. And in the traffic manager, you can see here, I have two endpoints. Endpoint one, which is the West US, and endpoint in Southeast Asia. Both are online. And right now, I have a routing method called priority. So my West US gets priority. If West US is unavailable, it is going to go to Southeast Asia. Okay? Easy to set up, right? And you can set up a probe, and your probes can be different, and you know, there's a lot of flexibility. You can have nested endpoints and things like that. So there's a lot of flexibility there. So that is the traffic manager. Let me just quickly show you the virtual network. And you can see here in this virtual network, I have the VM scale set, and I have the load balancer here as well. You're probably wondering, Vishwas, what happened to the app service environment? Remember, we deployed our web app into the virtual network as well? How many of you have deployed an Azure app service environment? Okay. For how many of you, it's too early to raise your hands? Okay. All right. So so here's the... So I promised to you that I deployed an app service environment, and it is actually deployed to the VNet. In fact, let me just go quickly show you this. Let's just go to the web app. And guys, this is a 200-300 level session, so I did not get a chance to explain all of the Kudu engine and the web apps and things like that. So if you're not familiar with these concepts, I'll be available after this session. You can talk to me or go back and look at these concepts and look at the recording. So here is the web app, and let's just copy this web app, and notice here, something very interesting here. Notice here, this P right here, this tells you that this is a private cluster, okay? Let's just copy this URL here. Okay, and what I'm going to do is, let's just bring this up. So it is right now connected to the primary database, this application. Is connected to the primary database. What I can do, here's a little trick for you guys. I can actually jump into the Kudu engine. And if you're not, so right here, what I did was I prefixed SCM right here, which allows me to go into the Kudu engine. Let's just try to go into the Kudu engine, which is the engine that sort of powers this web app. And this will come up in a second here. And right here, so this gives me some internal information about this site, and let's just go into the environment tab here, and let's just look for right here. Sorry. Notice that the internal IP address assigned to my cluster is the same that was assigned to the VNet. Okay, it's fine. So we've shown you that I have a website, it is all connected to the VNet. Let us now go back here and let us go to the database. And let's just go to the Southeast Asia database server. And then I'm going to go into the database itself. And notice here that I have geo-replication option available. Let's just go into that. Let's go into geo-replication. And this will bring up, it'll show me what primary and secondary I have. So right here is my, this replication is taking place from the West US data center to the Southeast Asia data center. And my primary right now is the West US, and my secondary is the Southeast Asia one. Let's just try to do a failover. And just do a failover right here. And this can take, sometimes it does it in 20 seconds, sometimes it takes longer. And what I've done inside my web application is, notice this is the point I was trying to make earlier, that you need to figure out what is your recovery time objective, what is the recovery point objective. If you fail over to a secondary data center, there's a change in connection string, and you have to account for that in your time for mitigation. Okay? In this case, what I've done is in my web application, I have logic which says go to the primary, go to the primary, go to the primary, and if three retry attempts fail, then I change the connection string and start going to the secondary. Okay? So if this is successful, then we should be able to go back to our application. And looks like, there you go. Okay? So see this right here. What happened was, right here, you can notice here that we are now connected to the Southeast Asia data center because the failover just happened. Okay? So this is one example of how you can start out with, you know, look at when you're modeling your architecture. This is at the different service boundary. You can look at each service. You can look at what are the SKUs that are available. You can look at what kind of resilience options are available to you. And then once you have done that, you draw a component interaction diagram and say, yes, I have local resilience, but what if the VNet fails? What if the database fails? What if the web app fails? And all these can be temporary failures. How do I recover from it? And having another region, and this the secondary region, that's interesting to note, the secondary database can be a lower SKU than the primary, so you're not paying the same amount. Right, and then you can fail back to your primary when it is available. So there are some things you can do there to conserve resources and the amount of money you spent. Okay, so moving back to the slide deck. And I'm going to project again so that it shows up on the second screen. Yes, it does. And let's just try to find where we left off. We were right here. Just to give you, we talked about applying RMA. Just make sure you're all following along. We talked about the end-to-end scenario, right? And then we talked about the workbook. We talked about the cloud service boundaries. Here's how we updated our architecture. We added the traffic manager. Then we added replication. Then we added storage, RAGRS options so that the table storage was available. We talked about RTable. We talked about spreading out and making our VMs highly available using VM scale set. And then finally, we talked about how you can deal with service bus and how you can need to have duplicate message handling to do that. And this is just an example of how you go about protecting your applications. Okay. The next thing I want to talk about is, so we did the demo. The next thing I want to talk about is component by component discovery. And this is where we are going to drop inside code, because we have taken a high level user view, then we've taken a service view, and now we are going to pick out a certain set of components and say, take a quick look at this component and see how we can improve the reliability of this application. So what I'm going to do here is, let's just bring up this slide, and I'm going to shuttle between this slide and some code snippets, because slides are only so interesting. Looking at the code is more interesting. So here are some patterns, and you know, learning through my mistakes, learning through mistakes of other cloud developers. So you're doing a code review of your most critical component, let's say, and here are some things. These are just examples, not an exhaustive list. Here are some things that you can bring up in code review which can have a big impact on the overall availability. You know, I often talk to developers and you know, who are asking this, I'm building application for the cloud and I generally understand the cloud services. What do I need to do at the code level to improve the resilience of my application? And here are some things that developers can do to sort of make that cloud journey successful. So first and foremost, this has bitten us. First and foremost, very simple pattern called cache aside pattern. And I'm sure many of you have seen this. The Redis cache instance that we talked about, even though we were running a premium SKU of that, it gives you 3 nines of availability, okay? Which means your Redis cache can go down. And if you don't have cache aside built into your application, you've created a single point of failure. The idea of the cache aside pattern is that you use cache for what it is good at, optimize your application, but if the cache is unavailable, you should be able to fall back to the authoritative data source. So that's the cache aside pattern. That's one. Let's just talk about a couple of them here, and then we'll look at the code so we don't have to keep flipping back and forth. So that's one important pattern. Exception handling becomes super critical in the cloud. We have often heard failed fast idea, and you can do that. But if you fail fast and you bubble up the exception back to the caller, you've now created, given them a DDoS entry point. People know they need to pass these values and they'll cause this exception and you'll get the return this message. So you need to be cognizant about the cost of throwing the exception and what you're bubbling up. And what people have done is maybe you let the exception bubble up, but you don't log every exception. You can, and I'll show you an example. What I do is I actually log the exception to table storage, but I do a quick check if that exception has already been logged, and then only add a new unique instance of that, or log every hour, or something like that. You know, giving due consideration to how logging is happening is important. So I talked about two and three sort of together. So exception handling, the cost of exception handling, and how are you logging? Because we have had a failure where we kept logging and logging, and you know, a million messages because of a bug, a million messages got logged. All of the drive on that worker role got filled up, and that caused an outage. Right. So logging is important, and how do you log and how do you truncate the logs is important. The fourth item here is the retry logic, super critical, because there can be transient failures in the cloud, and I'm going to pick on Redis cache in this example because you know I have some code samples there, but it applies equally to other services as well. If you are using the Redis cache client, it has retry logic built into it when you're connecting to the Redis cache. So you can say, open a connection, and you can say the number of retry attempts to obtain a connection. But there is no retry mechanism built in when you're trying to retrieve a value of the cache or storing a value of the cache. So you need to think about that carefully and build retry logic into that. So let's do this. I'm going to bring up another machine here. I just go here and so here's some code that I want to show you guys. So here's my cloud controller. Let's just go here to get authors. And so here you can see, if you notice this line right here, can you guys see in the back hopefully? Or we bump up a little bit more. So you can see here that I have a very simple method called getAuthors. And this is the very simple implementation of cache aside pattern. I first go to the cache, and if the cache is unavailable, then I go to the database right here. Okay? This is a very simple cache aside. Let's look inside the cache. And here's the cache provider. Let's just go in here, and let's look at the cache provider one more level deep. And there is a library out there. You've probably heard of some interesting open source code that Netflix provided, which they built a retry logic and circuit breaker pattern. There is a C# library available called Poly. I've used that here. And in case of Poly, what I've done is I've set up a policy here. So the key thing to note here is that you don't want to put this repetitive code and have every developer make that decision, because you know chances are that will not be consistent. What you want to do is you set up a policy, how many retry attempts you want and how much time you want to wait, and you should be able to switch these policies. And Poly allows you to do that. So I've hidden all that retry logic in that provider code, and I'm using the Poly library. I set up a policy, and then when I access the cache, this retry policy is being used. Okay? So this is a simple example of the retry logic. Let's just go back here, and let's just go and look inside the database calls here. And one thing I have not talked about is but something called the circuit breaker pattern. And this is an important pattern. So you are in the UI tier, and you're calling your business tier. And maybe there are 10 different services in the business tier. Maybe one of them is acting up, having some kind of a delay. If you keep calling that one and keep adding to the queue, you're impacting everybody else. So the circuit breaker pattern, very simple pattern, is that try to call it 3 times or whatever your policy is, and if you're getting no response, break that circuit for 30 seconds, 60 seconds. So you're not, you know, adding to the queue unnecessarily because you know that that service is not working well. Okay, so that's an implementation of that is shown right here. So I get the data from the database, and let me just go in here, and you will see that I'm using a circuit breaker pattern. Once again, using the Poly library. And Poly gives you both retry and circuit breaker, and then I'm applying a circuit breaker pattern. And one other thing while I'm right here, I can show you that you know, rather than throwing an exception, I am capturing this information and then returning this information back up. And in fact, I just go one level back here and then just look at this. So you know, something happened there. I got an exception, I captured that into a serializable object, I sent it back, and then inside that serializable object, I call log error. And if you go into this log error method, you can see here that I'm going to table storage, and this may seem expensive, but you know, this will only get called when an exception happens. So it's fine. I go to the table storage, I check if this exception has happened in the last hour or so. If it has not happened, I'm going to log it. Otherwise, I'm going to ignore it because I already have information about this exception. Okay, make sense? So while we are here, I want while we are talking about the retry logic, I want to talk about, you know, how do you test your retry logic? Because we ran into a situation where we did indeed have retry logic. However, that retry logic was not sufficient. So we were using a highly HA version of the cache, which has a master-slave configuration. And when the master failed, they correctly failed over to the slave configuration. But it took about 40 seconds for that to happen. Our retry logic was designed to wait only for 30 seconds, and we errored out. So how do you test your retry logic? And I've been talking a lot about chaos testing. So how do you chaos test it? And what I'm going to show you, and I've blogged about this, is Microsoft has made an open source version of the Redis cache available on Windows. So I took that code and I injected chaos inside that code. Okay? So what I'm trying to show you here is your retry logic is as good when it has been tested in these chaos conditions. So how do I test it? The Redis cache service does not allow me to create chaos, right? So how do I test it? I have this open source server, I injected chaos in it, and I test my retry logic against that chaos server. Okay? So let's see an example of that right here. So right here you can see, hopefully this is big enough. I have the chaos server. So this is the Redis instance on Windows. It's a C++ code, injected chaos in this, and I'll show you how we injected, added some code. And then I'm running this locally, and then I took my retry logic and ran it against this. So It takes about 3-4 minutes to run, so I'm not going to run it, but here is an attempt. So I made 500 calls, and then I caused chaos to happen, and I'll show you what are the parameters for chaos. And it told me that out of 500 operations, 5 failed, which means my retry logic was able to, you know, deal with that chaos for the rest of the operations, okay? So how is this helpful? Well, I can try, you know, different chaos conditions, and I can adjust my retry logic, and I can have a better degree of confidence that my retry logic will work. And this is what, if I quickly show you here. This is the file that we added. And you can see here that, you know, these are the 3 parameters we defined. We changed that C++ code, and so you can set up an error probability of 70%. How long should that error last, and what is the time between failures? Because, you know, we want this to be able to run on a production system, and you don't want to cause outage. So you have to control this, and we give you these parameters to test it out. Okay, the thing to take away, you know, I know I went through this rather quickly, but the thing to take away from this last 2-3 minutes of description is that if you do indeed have retry logic, find ways to test it. And here's one example of how I tested it, got a code, applied chaos, and then tested my retry logic. Let's just go back to the slides here for a moment. So we talked about the cache aside pattern. We talked about exception handling consideration. We talked about retry logic. We also talked about chaos testing. We talked about the circuit breaker pattern. Let's talk a little bit about the canary, which many of you know. It's canary stands for like a test environment. And this is one of the root cause analysis from one of the outages that happened related to the Visual Studio Team service. And Brian Harry has a great blog on that. And what happened there was no code was changed. However, the Azure SQL database team changed the SQL compatibility. They rolled out a new version with a changed SQL compatibility. Okay? And what that resulted in is when they executed a certain stored procedure, the query plan for that stored procedure was impacted by that compatibility setting. And it so happened that now the new query plan expected a certain amount of memory to be pre-allocated, like a 1.5 gigs of memory to be pre-allocated to optimally execute that stored procedure. And now suddenly, you know, developers started logging in, everybody was executing that stored procedure. You did not make a change in the code, you did not make a change to the stored procedure. There was a change that was rolled out unbeknownst to you under the covers. And this is when, you know, environments like Canary environment where you can test this code before it becomes available, right? The next thing I want to talk about is initialization and sequence bugs. This is another thing that bit us. Anytime you make an assumption about a certain initialization sequence, you are increasing the probability of failure. And I have a code example to show you, because when you do have a failure and you're trying to recover, your recovery may not follow the sequence that you expect. And as a result, you may run into some kind of an initialization problem. I'll show you a code here, very interesting example. This is a worker role related example. And as you know, worker role has the onStart method. Most of you are Azure developers, you know the onStart method. So in the onStart method, you typically do number of initializations. And one of the things you want to do is you want to do some kind of a breadcrumbs because if you have done a certain initialization and the onStart gets called again, you don't want to go through that initialization again. So you leave a breadcrumb in one of the disks. What happened to us was the OS disk associated with the worker role was detached and then attached again. So onStart got called, and inside the onStart method, we went and looked for the breadcrumb. And those drives, the E and F drives, were preserved as they were before the attach, detach and attach. So our code assumed that this initialization had already happened, and it led to certain failures. So when you're doing code reviews for availability, if you run into a situation where you have some sort of a sequencing logic, you need to think about how in a recovery situation it will behave. Okay. So that's one I wanted to, we may just very quickly just want to take a look here. So here's an example. So let me just pull up the onStart method here. So here's the onStart method. And you know, the way to protect yourself, and let me just go inside the initialize method. The way to protect yourself is here's the breadcrumb, I do the initialization, and you know, in this case, the way I've dealt with this problem is, even if this breadcrumb exists, I do further checks here, right? So in this case, what was happening is in onStart method, I do a registry entry. I write that I created that registry entry. But even if I find the breadcrumb, I do a quick lookup of the registry entry to make sure I can deal with different order of sequences of errors. Okay, make sense? So I think we've talked about most of these. Let's quickly talk about the last two. So if you're making call to the external system, this one is a very important one. And oftentimes an external library will give you some kind of a timeout setting, and many times they will not honor that setting. So you call that external library, you set a timeout, and now you are bound by their execution. And you are saying to yourself, well, I'm going to use async. So you know, I'm not synchronously calling them, I'm calling async. But even if you're doing async, you have to think about if this goes endlessly, you have to think about completion ports, and are you exhausting ephemeral ports? So even if it is async, you have to be careful. And one thing you can do often is you can put a bound around these external calls yourself. Let's take a quick example here. So in this instance right here, look at the cloud patterns here. So for example, right here, in this instance, I'm calling an external service, Yahoo Weather Service, and if this fails, and you know, of course, this depends on your example, I go to another service, but let's take a quick look at this method right here. I come in here, I'm going to call this service, I'm not going to rely on their timeout, I'm explicitly setting a timeout here so that my call will be forced to complete. So if they don't respond within 5 seconds or 3 seconds, what have the case, I'm going to go to the second provider. Okay? So that's an example, once again, of how you can deal with async failures. And then last but not the least, the certificate issue is very common. And this has happened. I'm sure you can read various outage descriptions. So you are calling a service, the certificate expired, you go and you know go to the certificate revocation list, you go try to acquire a new certificate, but you know you have not opened that port up for that certificate to be refreshed. So one common pattern is that you are constantly checking inside your code, maybe causing you know, sending out alerts, for example. So let's just go here. So here's this example right here. I want to show this quickly, and basically come here. I can see the certificate right here, print this out into the log, and have my L1 flag my L1 team that you know the certificate is bound to expire, take some action. So not just relying on the process, but also actively looking out for these errors. Okay, so let's just go back to the slides here. So this concludes this demo. I want to talk about just a few that I did not get a chance to cover as part of the code or the service boundary example. So some other considerations, multi-home, for example. So we talked about a scenario where we have a primary database and we had a secondary database, but we explicitly failed over to the secondary, right? That requires a manual failover and may result in some data loss depending on, you know, what is the data transfer expectation for your application. Ideally, you want to go to a multi-homed scenario where you have a multi-master configuration where you have two primaries running. SQL Server supports multi-master. Azure SQL Database does not yet support a multi-master configuration, but that will be an ideal scenario where your both the configurations are active at the same time. So that's one, if you can get to it, if you are using certain technologies that allow a multi-master, then you should absolutely consider that. Let me talk about the aggregate SLA example. So if you are using a service which provides, let's say, 3.9 of availability, you can yourself run a second instance of that service and sort of send messages in both the instances to improve your SLA ability for that application. In fact, that's exactly what I did as part of this. Let me very quickly show you an example of that here. So I have this application right here. What I've done here is just bring this up. Let's just write to this. So, you know, because the cache is giving me 3.9s of SLA, I created two caches, and then I wrote to both of them. And as you can see, both are available, and they're writing to it. And as you can see, both were successful. Success on the primary, success on the secondary. Okay. Let us now go here into this in Azure, and both are Redis cache instances in Azure. I'm going to recycle one of the instances. Okay. So before I do, let me just go back to my application. Let's also run a read report here instead of write. And the read can be from any of the cache instances, primary or secondary. Everybody see what's happening here? I've created a primary and secondary. Write happens to both. Read can be from either. Let's start the read operation. And you can see both primary and secondary are being read, no problem. Let's just go in here, go to Azure. I have a PowerShell script here. I'm going to recycle one of the role instances. And let's just see, do that here. And this takes a few seconds for it to reboot that Redis cache instance. Let's just go back to my application. You should start seeing here that there is a failure. See, the primary stopped reading this value, but we are still reading from the secondary. Okay? So there are things you can do yourself to improve the availability. If that SLA is not acceptable to your needs, then maybe you want to have a secondary instance. You are taking additional complexity, granted, but then you are getting an added measure of reliability. I can actually stop here, and you will see that some of these read instances, once it completes, some of these read instances will be from the primary and secondary. The graph takes a second to refresh. Okay. And the last thing to note here is recursive restartability. So think about your application as different parts. How can you restart the application so you can at least provide, even if it is degraded performance, you can at least provide your application. It's not completely down. So think about partial restartability for your application. And this last bullet is equally important. And many of you may or may not know this, that if you have a high-scale event coming up, you can call Azure support ahead of time and ask for that extra capacity limits so that when time comes to scale, you're not out of cores, not out of storage accounts and things like that, and you're able to scale. So plan ahead when you need to. All right, so this brings me to the last call to action slide here. So think about RMA process as part of your development lifecycle. We talked about creating a component interaction diagram. We talked about the RMA workbook. Model your failures. Think about the effect of the failure. And then once you've done that, think about the failures from an end user perspective, from the service boundary. Remember the service boundaries discussion. And then that's not quite enough. Take important parts of your application and do a code review based on reliability thinking. And then once you've found these failures, address them. And then this is where it determines how much investment are you going to make to conduct chaos tests. And then last but not the least, this is not a one-time exercise. You need to conduct this exercise on a periodic basis. And then I have a couple of references here. This slide deck will be available to you. But I have a couple of references. There is a talk by Mark Sims, who I referenced earlier. excellent talk on availability. Go check it out. And then Mark Rusinovich, Azure CTO, did a talk on building resilient services at Build this year. I highly recommend you check that talk out, some additional considerations, okay? So with this, with 1 minute to go, we come to the end of this session. Thank you for coming to the session early in the morning. I appreciate it. And I'll be around if you have more questions. Thank you for being a great audience.